Okay, so my role is with I'm the chief scientific officer for the Soil Health Institute. Now, the interesting secret about that is I'm the only scientific officer for the Soil Health Institute. So I win all the arguments on chief scientific officer stuff. It's remarkable, but. You know, we at the Soil Health Institute, we're a relatively new organization. It was it's a nonprofit that was founded in late 2015. I came on in May of 2016, and we're established around this definition. Everybody these days is putting this up there. It can become a little bit gratuitous after a while. Oh no, another one of those. But the fact of the matter is it's still there's still some differences in definition and how people are thinking about this and so forth. So I think it's worth it bears putting up here at the beginning of my talk that when I talk about soil health, I'm talking about this definition, consistent with the NRCS concept of it. It's the capacity of the soil to function as a vital living ecosystem that sustains plants, animals, and humans. And the key is this. It's alive. You know, we can talk about the soil quality in the same sense that we can talk about water quality or, you know, the quality of the food or air or, you know, the quality of some article of clothing you would buy, and you'd have these various attributes. But when you start talking about health, you got to be if you're going to talk about health, you got to be talking about something that's living. And so that's what's the important part of this. So there's a number of words in this definition that pull that together: vital, living, ecosystem, and so forth. And that's really what we're talking about, is a living system. Just so you know a little bit about the Institute, this is not a talk about the Institute, but we have a mission statement that says we are to safeguard and enhance the vitality and productivity of the soil through scientific research and advancement. In other words, we are a scientific organization. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Institute and some of its priorities at the end of the talk. But for now, that's what you need to know. We're a nonprofit. It's a small organization. We work through partnerships and collaborations. We get most of our base funding through the Noble Foundation in Oklahoma. We're also supported by the Farm Foundation and some other things. But basically, we're nonprofit, small, new. That's what you need to know at this point. I always think it's fun to put this slide up there because it's a look of shock that people have on it. This is a diagram that has been published in a number of books and places on the web about the impact of putting plant and animal residues and quote wastes to soil. And you really don't even need to read all of these boxes because it's just the visual impact to this. We are dealing with a pretty complicated system, and there's a lot of feedbacks, and you see, you know, primary effects and secondary effects and subsequent effects on the soil system and environmental effects. And these arrows and boxes are all connected, and these things run all over the place like a wiring diagram. And some of these arrows and connections are stronger than others in terms of what we know and what we don't know. Others are pretty tenuous, and I would even say conjecture, even to the point of, you know, being good. And they'll point out good areas of research, and there are some research people here in the room, and you know they could use a diagram like this to say, well, you know, there are some areas of relating application of some materials to the land and so forth, and organic materials, and how this affects the various pieces of the soil system. You know, one could build a whole graduate course around this diagram, and you'd probably use this as a basis for a course. You could probably do a lot worse. You're lucky. That's not what I'm going to do today. Instead, I'm going to be honest, you know, as I sit here and listen to this group and the kinds of questions and the kinds of discussion that's going on, I doubt that you're going to learn much new from me today in terms of things that you've never heard before. What I'm hoping that we might do over the course of the next 15 minutes or so is fill in a table. And what I'm going to try to do with filling in this table is relate what we call, you know, the basic principles of soil health, and these have been elaborated pretty well by NRCS, and you can find these on the NRCS website. A number of practices that we know address these principles. If you're interested in these principles and having them on your land, there are some things we know you can do that will, like I said, it's the journey, not the destination. So if you do some things, we can kind of move you in the direction of addressing those principles because we know that they have some benefits. We've heard about some of those in the presentations by the students and others here this morning. Really good stuff. Obviously, some uncertainties and things that vary. Well, depends on which soil you're on and what background is, uh, the the history of the field and so forth. But we know that some of these practices have benefits that address these principles. So then my question will be, well, okay, this is about four R's, right? Source, right rate, right time, right place. How do these line up with that? So many of you are here thinking about four R's. Some of you are here thinking about soil health. Like I said, I don't know that you're going to hear anything that you haven't heard before from me here this morning, but what I'm going to try to do is pull these together on a single table and show you how they line up. And if you're thinking about one, you're really thinking about the other. And that giving attention to one of these concepts really gives you a springboard to a lot of different things. And then finally, just to wrap it up, maybe a little bit of a commercial here at the end, I'll tell you a little bit about what some of the research emphasis and priorities are in terms of the Institute's priorities, and we'll look at that at the very end and use that as a way to wrap up. So let's start. Okay, these principles are out there. We have already heard. I think Kirsten, when you listed one of your slides, you listed a bunch of practices that are up there, and they address these principles. And so you've already introduced that for us. And you know, the first one of these is, by the way, these are my paraphrasing of them. You get the formal phrases off the website, but this is the way I think of them. You know, the first one is keep it covered. And here we're talking about practices that are no-till, reduced tillage, things that will help keep the soil covered. We know some of the effects that this has in terms of, you know, somebody talked about, Kirsten, I think it was you again, split fields, you know, going from small plots to split fields. It's a classic example of that, just looking right down a fence row in which the field on the left has no-till, the field on the right has conventional tillage. It's been a good hard rain, and you can see the potential for erosion and ponding and standing water. Whereas on the left side, you can see that that you don't see that kind of water. We know what the benefits of doing this are. We have carbon accumulation from the residues that are applied. We have nutrient return as these things break down. You have nutrients being returned to the soil. We reduce erosion, and you can sort of get that implication from the photo here. Water penetration, a lot of benefits from keeping the soil covered. What's that mean, though, with respect to the four R's? Well, if you look in terms of thinking of this as the right source, you've got all these complex biological sources, roots, stems, leaves, the chemical composition of these, a lot of lignin, cellulose, hemicellulose, a lot of carbon, nitrogen-containing materials, phosphorus, everything else. These are all complex organic. You're putting on a delayed-release fertilizer. These are going to be cycled by the microbes and made into eventually plant-available forms, but that's not the form that they go onto the soil as. They go onto the soil pretty much as plant-unavailable forms, and it takes these microbial transformations to make them available. In terms of the right rate, yeah, this is a slow-release fertilizer. Again, you know, you're going on the soil with things that are not readily available, but they become available to plants as time goes on. I would say you're fairly unlikely to over-apply nutrients, although you can if you go berserk about these sorts of things. But you're unlikely to do that over-apply in the forms that can be readily leached. So if you're applying these organic forms, it's not like you're dumping on a huge amount of nitrate gratuitously, and you're going to see a lot of leaching and so forth. The right time, here again, you're dealing with slow release. The decomposition rate is greatest when the microbes are active. When is that? Spring, when things warm up, over the course of the summer, as long as you've got good moisture and so forth, things slow down in the fall and the winter. And so the release is going to be greatest from these materials when you've got an actively growing crop. And in terms of the right place, guess what? It's already where the next crop's going to be. So you've addressed that one as well. So I think if you keep it covered, if you're thinking in terms of, well, I want the four R's, right source, right rate, time, and place, and you're thinking in terms of soil health, of keeping it covered, you've got a good alignment. You can address both of these ideas. Moving down the list, we'll squeeze the first one up there. We don't want to lose it, but we'll squeeze it. So the second one is don't disturb it. And this is, in a sense, a variation on keep it covered. Just don't plow it to death. Use reduced tillage. And again, we have the same kind of ideas. We have these residues that are accumulating on the soil. One of the things that we see in terms of these of the benefits of this is in many soils, particularly those with not much organic carbon to start with, is the increase in available water holding capacity. That top line, let's see if I can use this pointer without, it doesn't use the pointer. Okay, well, the top line there is field capacity. That's the amount of water that a soil will hold against gravity. The lower line is permanent wilting point. That's the line at which a plant can't extract any more water out of the soil. And in the zone in between, that gray zone, that's the available water to a plant. Okay, it's somewhere between what can be held against gravity versus what the root can actually extract itself. And the idea is that in a very sandy soil, if you can increase the amount of organic carbon, you see that both of those lines go up. But the neat thing is that the field capacity line goes up faster. And that zone is wedge-shaped, which means that the more carbon you can put into a low-carbon soil, the more likely you are to increase that available water-holding capacity. So as my boss, Wayne Honeycutt, says, adding soil carbon won't make it rain more, but if it does rain, it will enable you to hold on to a little bit more for the plants than if you weren't doing some of these practices. The benefits of this can be seen in crop yields. This is the corn yields in 2012, which was a pretty disastrously drought year. And in the Midwest, with cover crops averaged about 10% higher yields than those that had not been cover cropped. Again, getting back to this whole thing of reduced tillage and not disturbing and so forth, and using cover crops to accomplish that. So again, you know, similar ideas that we talked about, right source. Again, it's residues that are being cut up by insects, decomposed by microbes, and turned into plant available forms that are going to be available in the root zone. Slow release from these decomposing organic forms that you put on. Slow release in terms of rate. It's available in the spring and the summer with an actively growing crop. And once again, it's in the place where you want it to be when that crop is growing. So by addressing this principle of don't disturb it, using reduced tillage and some other techniques, you can address these four R's. Keep roots growing. Again, this is one of the very basic principles of trying to address soil health. In terms of practices, here we've got cover crops, various kinds of rotations. We've got perennial pastures. We actually have planned pasture mixes like this one. We can see what the benefits are in terms of this. This is a field on the upper left that's been left fallow in the wintertime, and you can see a lot of erosion, and as compared to the field on the right with a close-up, you can see how clear that water is and where that water, you know, there's really very little sediment in there. And so this idea of putting a crop on there and using a rotation and perennial pastures and so forth, we see this carbon accumulation. We see a lot of microbial growth and water penetration. This also allows for nutrient input, benefits in aeration and so forth. Those are the benefits on the soil health side. In terms of the four R's, again, we've got these organic forms. And I'll keep returning to that idea. We're putting organic forms on there that act as slow-release fertilizers. And so these are organic carbon forms of carbon and nutrients that get freed up by the microbes and turned into plant-available forms. The plants that are there can be pretty varied in terms of the kind of exudates and the kind of materials that they're depositing into the soil. So they'll stimulate some organisms that are beneficial and induce further turnover. There are implications for plant health that I'll get into for a minute. But again, this application is pretty constant during the growth or between the crops. And once again, it's on-site. It's an on-site form of on-site application and accumulation and decomposition. Biodiversity is a very interesting one. We think in terms of boosting biodiversity and by crop rotations, varied sequences, different kinds of sequences, multi-species cover crops and pastures, pasture mixes and so forth. And here again, this biological diversity that you're introducing is what gives you a lot of resilience in terms of the kinds of microbes and insects, the diverse population of those. The more diverse plant material you're putting in, you get more diversity of the other biological, the other life that's on site. So in terms of rotations, we see these mixtures that you can see in pastures and meadows If you look at the structure of the different kinds of root systems, they're highly varied. They put these materials in different places. Some of these plants exude high sulfur compounds that can be antagonistic to certain kinds of microorganisms. This can have an effect on disease resistance and insects that are there. And so this high level of diversity not only promotes a high level of microbial diversity and insect diversity, but there are a lot of benefits that accrue from having those. And at the microbiological level, the more diverse a principle would be, the more diversity you can see above the ground and looking at the field, you can assume there's greater diversity below ground in the things that you can't. In terms of the source, rate, time, and place, these deposit a lot of diverse chemicals, a lot of different exudates. Plant roots of different species are chemically can be quite different. Their decomposition rates are different, and what they're leaking out from the roots can be quite different. In terms of the rate, again, this is a slow release kind of form. It'll buffer the overall rate of application, and when some of these microbials, some of them are microbial stimulants, some of them are microbial antagonists, and these will be released at various kinds of forms over time. Again, the application in terms of the plant available forms, it varies with the source of organic material that you're putting in on the top. So the more diverse the plants are on the top in terms of rotations, mixtures, and so forth, the greater diversity you'll have below. And of course, once again, you're putting these things in the right place because that's where your next crop is going to be, and it's in the right place at the right time. Finally, the last one is sort of implied. It's part of this biodiversity, but I'm going to add it as a separate one, and that is involving animals. Not all production systems can accommodate animals, I understand that, but in terms of grazing livestock and applying manures, there are ways to get soil health benefits from that. Here's again one of these split field photographs where the field on the left has been pretty intensively grazed. You can see the cattle off in the distance there. On the right, just on the other side of the field, a less intensive grazing, more of a rotational grazing, and that has a lot of implications for the soil and soil health, and this is taken out of that field. The one on the left is under continuous grazing, and the core on the right is under rotational grazing. And the one on the right, you can see that how much the difference in soil carbon accumulation. If you don't like data, just look at it. It's darker, that dark zone extends to a greater depth. What's going on here is in grazing systems, and particularly those that have a lot of grasses, the top and the bottom of a grass plant is pretty well coupled, so that if the cow chews off maybe half the biomass on the top of the ground, about half of the root system dies. If it chews off 95%, about 95% of the root system dies. And the idea is if you can introduce this in terms of a rotational form and allow some of the biomass to be grazed off the top, but not all of it, the roots regenerate, and you've got this cycle of adding roots, bringing the animals in, allowing them to graze, the roots die, carbon inputs, and just cycling through this. So, in fact, if you can use a rotational grazing or some sort of non-continuous grazing, you can actually build carbon up in the soil while using grazing as a tool. And here again, you know, this additional diverse, and if you can't do that, bring in manures. Animal manures, if it's possible, those make a great source of additional biological diversity, diversity of these carbon compounds, organic forms that decompose and release in plant available forms over time. A little bit different in chemical composition, obviously, from the plant residues, but nonetheless the same idea. And so these very diverse organic inputs, they decompose at different rates. They stimulate microbes in different ways. It buffers the rate of overall application, that the rate at which these are turning into plant available forms. So the application, once again, in terms of the right time, you can time that for where you when you bring that material in. If it's grazing, you can time it in terms of putting the animals on the land based on the condition of the plants. In terms of some of these other organic sources, the decomposition also is a time-related thing. In terms of the right place, I would say the same thing about this as I said about some of the others in terms of plant materials. Probably one of the things you have to think about a little bit on applying animal manures is to make sure that you've applied them in the right place to avoid contamination of water. Getting this into surface waters and at times that you don't want it there, that's a consideration. There have been instances where we see animal manures that haven't been properly or composted or processed in a way. These may get on fresh harvested crops, vegetable crops. There have been a few unfortunate instances of, you know, contamination of food crops that way. So that right place and right time, there's some implications for manure applications. But in terms of the rest of this, in terms of sources and rates and times and so forth, you're once again applying these things in a form that aren't readily available to the crop, but become so later on. So I think if we look down through here, we've got the soil health principles of keep it covered and don't disturb it and keep the roots growing and boosting biodiversity and the various practices that will help us address that and the things that we think of as benefits to soil health. But I guess my argument is if you're thinking about those things, you're also working in this 4R realm. And if you're interested in applying 4R practices, one of the things you can think about is working some of these soil health related practices into the system. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that if you do this, you can completely eliminate all other forms of nutrient additions and so forth. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, what I'm saying is that this can become an important part of an overall system approach and something that you can think about in terms of diversifying the kind of inputs that you have. In terms of where we are with respect to research, I'll go back to the Institute itself. One of this is what we see as the various roles of the Soil Health Institute, and one of the things is to identify research and where research can be applied in terms of adoption gaps. Also, then building teams and partners. Again, like I said, we're a very small organization, so we try to be effective through building partnerships and networks. And identifying ways to find the resources to address the research that we think needs to be done. And what we're really interested in is not so much doing a lot of research and putting it in the scientific journals. We recognize that that's bread and butter for a lot of scientists. But what we don't want to see is that we do research and throw it over the wall and hopefully somebody's over there to pick it up and use it. We are very interested in impact, and so we work with the teams to try to ensure that what's being done is something that eventually will lead to impact. We use a highly iterative process of working with stakeholders and partners, and over the course of several years through an effort that was called the Soil Renaissance that led to the creation of the Soil Health Institute, a lot of input on research priorities and research gaps and how to get these things to be adopted in practice. And this led to what we call our action plan that's available on the web. If you go to soilhealthinstitute.org, you can find this action plan. It is not a strategic plan. It's not a 50,000-foot thing with principles in it. It's very specific. It's about 50 pages of research goals, very specific priorities, things that we think need to be addressed in terms of specific kinds of research gaps. And just to take a quick look at those, in terms of there's two major goals in the research section of the plan. Goal number one is enhance productivity and resilience through soil health. And again, some of the specific priorities that we think will address this is go back to this idea of optimizing water holding capacity in important agricultural soils. The exact prescription from this won't be the same for every soil that you go to. And so the question becomes what's really necessary maybe for a particular farmer to achieve and what would be the practices that would help get there in terms of actual water holding capacity. Another is this idea of water infiltration, penetration rate, aggregation. These are all related. What practices will get us there the fastest for a given kind of soil and what's achievable and what seems to be practical. And so that's optimization. this idea that by putting on organic residues, be they plant or animal, and suppressing soil-borne pathogens, this is an important part of crop yield and crop health. And so a lot of the microbiological aspects of what we advocate are related to disease suppression. And then finally, this idea, and we heard a little bit about this in the panel discussion, this idea of plant nutrient availability, the idea that in different soils and different crops, that availability changes, the demand changes. And so many of our recommendations are based on, you know, crop genotypes that have been around for a few decades, and maybe you're not planting those anymore, and the growth habit and the growth characteristics of the plants are a little bit different from when those standards were set. Maybe we need to go back and look at how we would optimize that with some more modern varieties and modern production techniques. The other major area of research is quantify and enhance environmental and human health benefits that result from improved soil health. A couple of those is this idea we heard about water quality this morning, improving water quality by increasing nutrient use efficiency so that the crop and the soil retains more and less of it gets into surface waters and we lose less nutrients that way. There's a lot of research that can be done in that area that we support. And then finally, this area of increasing carbon sequestration to sequester greenhouse gas emissions. That's an important goal for many people. If that's not one of your goals and you really don't care about greenhouse gas emissions, I would still say that adding carbon to the soil has a lot of soil health benefits and relates to the 4R practices. We also have some interest in human health benefits. That's kind of beyond the scope of what we're talking about here this morning. So when we look down through our, let's finish out the table. We got the principles on the left and the practices and then the benefits we see in soil health. Right source, right place, right time. We've pretty much covered that up. In terms of some of the research that goes into the reduced tillage, the action plan is, and I'll just speed things up. Basically, the action plan of the Institute goes all the way down the table. We have priorities and goals in all of these. We're constantly looking for new partners, new stakeholders to work with us on this, and of course, places to get the funding to fund the scientific community that will do this research. But I think that finishes out my table. I would just say one last thing before I end here. In terms of the action plan, research isn't the only thing that's in our action plan. In terms of research being to address what we don't know. We also need we have a lot of priorities related to measurement and assessment. We've talked a lot about how do you measure this, how do you do assessments, and that tells us what the current status is and what the trends are. Measurement and assessment is another broad area within the Institute's interest. Economic analyses, what are the costs, what are the benefits, what are the break-even points on applying this? I think that this is important in setting standards and deciding where we want to go with soil health practices and individuals making those decisions. Communications and education, we need to get the word out just because we know it. And we're all sit around and talk about it at a meeting doesn't mean meaning that it's getting out there. There's lots of different ways to do that. It used to be that you sort of, you know, put out a paper and maybe had a field day and that was it. But now we have lots of social media and other ways to get the word out, and we're interested in that. And finally, policy. We would like to see soil health being a cornerstone for decision-making in a lot of areas of natural resources and environment. We think it integrates it very well. We're not a policy shop, but we do advocate that the best science and the best experts are available to policymakers. So let me just wrap it up here. I'd say that in our view, that soil health represents a great framework for integrating an awful lot of managing soil, managing natural resources such as water and air with it, and advancing the idea of sustainability. Soil health is that intersection of physical, chemical, and biological properties of soil with the rest of the environment, and our land management practices get layered onto that. Somebody mentioned sustainability as a three-legged stool. The National Research Council called it a four-legged stool, but it's the same thing. It's the idea that it produces what we want to produce. It protects the Natural Resource Foundation. It gives us an economic incentive to keep doing it, and the fourth leg here is supporting the overall societal and infrastructural framework that enables it. You could call those last two the people part. I would argue that if you're addressing soil health and thinking about 4R nutrient management, you're looking at two different sides of really the same issue, and you're really really going a long way to address agricultural sustainability. So, Nick, I'm going to stop there and see if anybody has anything they would like to ask or whether we need to move on.
We may need to move on.
Okay.
Appreciate it, Steve.